Sox beat Baltimore. Tonight, the Brewers host the San Diego Padres. Cubs are in Pittsburgh. The White Sox play the Blue Jays in Toronto. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday, June 16th. Cloudy and very warm. High today, 82. Right now it's cloudy and 72. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes speaking on WGTD's morning show with the author of a remarkable new book called Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, The Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling. This is the story of someone who was known as the Mad Bomber, who terrorized New York City over the course of many, many years, setting off bombs in some of the most crowded public spaces in New York City, places like theaters and subway stations, a bus depot, a library, and it was terrorizing for the public and intensely baffling and frustrating for the New York Police Department. It seemed as though they had never dealt with something quite like this, and standard modes of operation were not going to serve them well in trying to figure out who in the world was doing this. And the police ultimately reached out to a psychiatrist who did groundbreaking work and really helped set the stage for bringing police work truly into the 20th century and into the age of scientific breakthrough. That is the story of this fascinating book, Incendiary. And it's written by Michael Cannell, already the author of The Limit, Life and Death on the 1961 Grand Prix Circuit, and other books as well. He was an editor at the New York Times for a number of years. His work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, The New Yorker, and many other places. This book is published by Minotaur, which is a division of St. Martin's Press, again called Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, The Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling. Michael Cannell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really excited about this. So is this a story that you already knew, or did you sort of uncover it somehow? I wonder how much it lives on in the minds of, for instance, people who live in New York City today.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think if you asked 100 people on the street in New York City if they knew about this story, 99 would say they did not, or maybe 100 would say they did not, which is remarkable when you think about it, because as you said, this serial bomber known as the Mad Bomber of New York really brought the city to its knees in the 1950s. It was arguably the first case of terrorism in America, and people got to the point where they were scared to go into department stores, they were scared to go to movie theaters. They eyed each other on the subway and buses with great suspicion. So it was the great story of the day and put an enormous fear into the culture of that time, at a time when the country had already entered into the dark stretch of the Cold War. It was a time when there were mushroom clouds, were images of mushroom clouds were on the front page of newspapers and on the evening news. So there was a kind of anxiety at large to begin with, and then this mad bomber, the serial bomber, came along, and he kind of focused that anxiety, and all of people's darkest fears kind of centered around him for this long stretch of the 1950s.
Hmm. Before we get to the matter of the psychiatrist who helped ultimately identify this perpetrator, let's talk more about this series of bombings, and a little more about the specifics of exactly how these bombs would be set off. They occurred over the course of many years, and I think 32 bombs in all. Tell us when this spree of bombings began.
Well, the first bomb was planted in 1940. It was a dud, and I think the bomber intended for it to be a dud. He placed it in a Con Edison power plant, a utility power plant on the far west side of Manhattan, with a threatening note. And the police puzzled over this because they thought, why would somebody put a note with the bomb? If the bomb went off, you wouldn't be able to read the note. But it was really the bomber just announcing himself, and there would be, as you said, you know, 31 bombs to come after that one. Most of the bombs were concentrated in the mid to late 1950s. He made these bombs by himself. The bombs grew progressively stronger, more sophisticated in their construction, and in the latter part of his bombing campaign, he was placing the bombs with intent to kill. He was focusing at the end on movie theaters where there were dense concentrations of people sitting in the dark. He shrewdly figured out that was the way to kill people.
Right.
He never did kill anybody. He very seriously wounded 15 people, but it was very clear that he was going to kill and probably kill a lot. And for that reason, the police were in just a flat-out panic at the end to catch him.
Do I remember correctly, however, that the early bombings did not seem designed to kill, but rather to terrorize and perhaps injure? I mean, the fact that often these bombs would be, in a sense, tucked away in places just a little bit off the busiest thoroughfares, for instance, or is it unclear just what the intention was even in those instances?
Yeah, it's very strange. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he believed that he was engaged in a moral crusade against Con Edison and by extension all of its all of corporate America and the government. He believed that these powerful forces were conspiring against him. And he believed that the newspapers would take up his cause. And so in the very early phase of the bombing, he would typically set off a bomb, for example, in the lower concourse of Grand Central Station. It would cause, you know, enormous panic at the height of rush hour. It would boom like a cannon through the corridors of the train station. It would fill the lower part of the train station with smoke. But as you said, he carefully placed the bombs a little bit out of the way so that they were less likely to kill people. When he saw that the newspapers did not take up his cause, he became even more enraged, and at that point he changed his strategy and began placing them with intent to kill.
We should mention that the way the book is set up, that you are actually putting us in the mind of the bomber in certain chapters, and one of the scenes that we see play out repeatedly is of this man reading through stacks of newspapers and looking for the coverage of the latest bomb, and he would be very, very frustrated and even enraged if a given bombing would not be given the attention that he felt it was due.
Yeah, that's right. He felt that he was leading a campaign, not just for himself, but for all the, you know, all the blue collar workers, all the little people in the United States against these corporate forces. He believed it was a great, moral war that he was waging, and he sent letters to the New York Journal American newspaper, which essentially was like his version of a manifesto, stating why he was going to do this.
He would also, of course, in letters taunt the police for their sort of ham-handed attempts to bring him to justice and even to identify him, and that had to make this situation even more difficult for the police.
Yeah, for the police, of course, it was a long form of agony. The 1950s was kind of the opposite of today. Today, the headlines in cities like New York are all about record lows in homicide and crime. In the 1950s, it was the opposite. Homicides were spiking. They were at an all-time high, and all sorts of crime was on the way up, and people feared lawlessness. And then along came this bomber, which, you know, the police really could not catch. And it led the public to wonder whether the municipal authorities were really up to keeping them safe. And by extension, whether the federal government was up to keeping them safe in regard to the Cold War. So there was a lot of anxiety surrounding this, a lot of, you know, panic. And the police, as you said, the police chased this bomber for years and years, and they just simply could not catch him. They were relying on the old-fashioned police tactics, you know, the old cop on the beat. They believed in old-fashioned policing. And, you rough up a suspect and you lean on informants, and that was the way police work was done. But in desperation, they had to change their tactics, and they went to a psychiatrist.
Mm. A couple other things about the nature of the bombings, and then we'll get to the way in which he was finally identified. You tell us at one point that this man who would identify himself in these letters with the initials FP, you tell us at one point that he was not like serial arsonists. He got no sexual charge from seeing his devices explode or witnessing the panic they incited. So tell us if it wasn't about that. I mean, if it didn't give him that kind of pleasure or satisfaction, what was the nature of the pleasure or satisfaction that he derived from this?
Well, the background to this is that he was a worker in a Con Edison power plant, and he had been injured in a furnace blast, a furnace explosion, and as a result, he had gotten tuberculosis. And so he had a legitimate worker's grievance against Con Ed. But because he was a paranoid schizophrenic, because he was a sick man, he believed that Con Ed had conspired against him. And as I mentioned earlier, that all of the corporate forces, everybody associated with Con Ed, had conspired against him. And so this was not a sexual crime. This was not a sexual instinct that he had. He was trying to fight back against what he saw as these great conspiratorial powers.
Hmm. And it's interesting, in the patterns of his bombs also included something that really ratcheted up the terror he was able to stir up, namely that he would often return to a place where he had set off a bomb. For instance, a particular movie theater would be the target of yet another bomb. Maybe, I don't remember now if it would be months later or years later, but that, in a sense, had to just heighten the sense of terror in the minds of everybody in New York. You just did not know where he was going to strike, and he might strike where he had struck before or strike in some new place. There was just no way to know.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and he was a paranoid schizophrenic. Paranoid schizophrenics are hard to catch because They are crazy. They are setting off bombs. But they can function very shrewdly and intelligently. And his actions in creating terror was very calculated and kind of brilliant. He knew exactly how to create the maximum amount of terror with the minimum amount of hardware. I mean, these bombs were powerful, dangerous bombs, but they were not nuclear bombs. They were homemade bombs. But he knew exactly how to work them in order to incite panic. So, you know, if you were the manager of a movie theater and your movie theater was bombed, you might think, well, that's over with now. It's not going to happen again. But as you said, he very shrewdly would come back to those movie theaters. And there's a quote from him after he was caught. There's a quote from him in which he said his theory was that you could destroy a battleship if you hit it with a small hammer enough times. And that's how he operated as a bomber. It was just the constant drip, drip, drip of terror that really drove people in the city to fear and panic.
Mm. So the other part of this really important story is of New York Police Captain Howard Finney reaching out to an actually little-known psychiatrist by the name of Dr. James Brussel for his help, and inadvertently, of course, beginning what becomes ultimately the whole field of criminal profiling. I love the way you describe the initial meeting between the police captain and a couple of his officers and the psychiatrist. You write, "To street-hardened detectives, a psychiatrist carried no more weight than a psychic or a fortune teller." So they were there. I mean, at least these officers were there very feeling quite skeptical about what the psychiatrist was going to have to offer to them. And, of course, they proved to be wrong. Just say a word about the kind of help that that this man was ultimately able to give them.
Yeah, I'll backtrack just a little bit and say that if you think about the 1950s, this was a time when scientific advancements were making inroads into all sorts of aspects of American life in medicine, the polio vaccine, and technology, and the first developments that would lead to everyday use of the computers. One area where scientific advancement was not employed was in police work. The police were really resistant to any kind of improvements or help in this area. The police thought, what can somebody with a college education do to help us? Certainly somebody in a forensics lab, they can't help us. Police work is done the old-fashioned way. And so they were resistant to seeking out help from somebody like a psychiatrist. Howard Finney, who was the head of the bomb squad, had a very different attitude. He was a highly educated man, a very, very intelligent and kind of broadly educated man. And he had concluded that the police had to find a new tact if they were going to catch the bomber. It was what we would now call thinking outside the box. And so he took two of his bomb squad colleagues, two detectives, to Dr. Brussel's office. And the two detectives that came with him, they were like little boys who had been forced to go to mass. They just squirmed and rolled their eyeballs. They thought it was a big waste of time. It turned out to be a very good use of time.
And, of course, we want to leave it to our listeners to really follow this phase of the story, which is so fascinating. Just give us a sense of what Dr. Brussel was able to pursue in terms of the scant information available to him. What was the nature of the sort of breakthroughs that ultimately led to this gentleman being identified?
Yeah, well, first let me say that Dr. Brussel was the he was a employed by the state of New York, and he was responsible for operating a lot of the mental asylums in New York State. These were, in those days, grisly, overrun institutions where they performed frontal lobotomies and other very crude procedures on violent inmates or patients. I don't, you know, I'm not intending to pass judgment about that. It's the only thing they had to treat these patients. But the point is that Dr. Brussel had seen a lot of the violent and dark aspects of human nature that the rest of us don't see. And as a result, he had certain insights into human nature. Now, part of what's kind of funny about this is that Dr. Brussel himself was just about as crazy as the inmates in those asylums. He himself was really, really eccentric. He must have had a kind of compulsive disorder because he compulsively wrote crossword puzzles, which were published in several of the New York newspapers, and he did so after compulsively drafting the crossword puzzle grids with pencils that he compulsively sharpened and arranged compulsively on his desk. And he dictated his wife's hairstyle and what she would wear and who her friends should be. And I mean, he was also a drug addict. But he was a brilliant. He was, you know, arguably a genius. And he believed that psychiatry could do more in the world than address the problems of these tortured souls in the asylums. He thought this, you know, psychiatry should be used to solve the great problems of the day, and he was thinking about ways that that could work. And so by the time the police came to his office, he had already thought about how he would help the police in cases like this. And so the police showed him all of the evidence. They emptied two big satchels of evidence on his desk, all the bomb parts and the forensic evidence and strange letters that the bomber had written to newspapers. And Dr. Brussel thought about all this evidence for an hour or so. And then he said, the man you're looking for is from a Slavic background. He's middle-aged. He's never had a girlfriend. He lives with an older female relative in a northern suburb of the city. And he has a history of workplace disputes. And when you catch him, he'll be wearing a double-breasted jacket, and it will definitely be buttoned up. And in fact, they went, when it's some weeks later, they knocked on the door of a bedraggled house in Waterbury, Connecticut, north of New York. The door was answered by a middle-aged man who fit that entire description.
It's an extraordinary story, and we leave it to our listeners to pursue every last intriguing detail in your fascinating book called Incendiary, The Psychiatrist, the Mad Bomber, and the Invention of Criminal Profiling, published by Minotaur Books and the author Michael Cannell. Michael Cannell, congratulations on a really fantastic book. I loved it, and I was really glad we could talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. And here's part two from the Morning Show archives. We are off to New England today, at least figuratively speaking, as I speak to the author of a really interesting book called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Professor Douglas Wynot, who teaches creative writing at Emerson College in Boston, has written a number of books which bring alive certain facets of American life, including A Country Practice, Scenes from a Veterinary Life, and A Unit of Water, A Unit of Time, Joel White's Last Boat, and following the bloom across America with the migratory beekeepers. In the sugar season, Professor Wynot is giving us a thorough and wide-ranging view of essentially the maple syrup business, and helps us to encounter and meet and understand those who tap the maple trees, and of what can be done with that wondrous sap, and of how this is an industry which is expanding, becoming global in its scope, accessing new technologies, and yet at the same time holding on to many traditions. And even as it becomes a very global entrepreneurial kind of exploit, it is also in many cases very much family-based, family-rooted. And the clash between old and new practice and mounting concerns about how climate change is altering the potential for the maple industry in the United States, all of that complicates the lives and, in a sense, enhances the drama which we follow in this book published by Da Capo Press, again called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. And Professor Douglas Wynot, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Really happy to be speaking with you about this.
Here.
I suspect that as you began this book, you at least had some basic vague notion that it would be more interesting and more complicated than it might appear to be on the surface. Am I right? Or as you undertook this, did you already have a pretty good sense that this would be, in a sense, a complicated story?
I had a sense of the basic story. When we moved to New Hampshire, my wife became a elementary school teacher, and she began taking her third grade class to a sugar house every year to learn about that business and the local economic culture. So when she went there, she took me on the weekend, and it became a ritual for us. We started going to the sugar houses regularly and going to other sugar houses. In 2009, when I heard about the discovery of an invasive insect in Worcester, Massachusetts, called the Asian longhorn beetle, and the cutting down of 20,000 trees, I began to wonder what would happen if that bug got up into New Hampshire and Vermont and got into the maple trees. What would happen to the maple syrup industry? So I called the sugar maker who lives not far from where I live. His name is Bruce Bascom, and he's the largest maple syrup producer in New Hampshire and the largest processor of maple syrup in the United States now. He wasn't when I first called him. And I asked him about this insect, and we talked about it a bit, but he wasn't all that concerned about it. He is concerned, but not all that concerned because the quarantine is fairly effective and the bug moves slowly. But in that conversation, he told me there's a lot more to the maple syrup industry than people realize. And so that seemed very interesting, and I asked if we could talk further. And at the end of that conversation, he told me that his tapping crew was going out into the woods to begin tapping trees, drilling holes in trees for the beginning of the season. And I asked if I could go along and watch. He said, sure, just show up at 7:30 and see what happens. So that began 3 years of research, watching them do their work and following three maple syrup seasons.
Mm. As I read your book, I was transported back to a time when I was probably in second grade or so, where I was on some sort of school field trip, and although not to New England, certainly, where I got to sort of see this for myself. But I suspect there are all kinds of listeners who've either never seen what you've seen, or if it's been so long, they've completely forgotten. So let's just start with the basics. When one has a grove of maple trees, what does one do with them? And maybe beginning with how it was once done.
Well, in the very beginning, it was done by Native Americans. Indians taught the settlers how to do this. They had primitive methods of scoring trees and draining sap into hollowed-out logs and then placing hot rocks in them to boil the sap down until it was at the sugar stage. And they took it, in many cases, all the way to hard sugar. But they learned from the settlers how to use pots and various kinds of pans to boil with, and the industry progressed on. at the turn of the century, they were making more syrup. They couldn't compete with the white sugar market any longer. And so we get up to Bruce Bascom's father, who was hanging buckets on trees and using horses to haul tanks to gather the syrup and then boiling it, boiling down 45 gallons of syrup to make a 45 gallons of sap to make a gallon of syrup. And so that way of using buckets to gather sap was the traditional way for many, many years. But the industry declined from the Civil War period down to about 10% of what it was in the 1960s, and that was partly because of labor costs and various other reasons. And during that time, plastic tubing began to be used to transport the sap from the trees to the tanks. And Bruce Bascom graduated from college in 1972. He had gone to the business school at the University of New Hampshire and come back to the farm and decided that plastic tubing was the future, that it was a way to make maple syrup production a commercial venture, a profitable one. So he converted the farm to plastic tubing, and before long they had 25,000 taps on plastic tubing and were the largest producers in New Hampshire. Today he's still the largest producer in New Hampshire and as I said, one of the largest in the country. He made 28,000 gallons of maple syrup last year.
Can you explain what a difference is made by the use of plastic tubing? I mean, is it for the sake of hastening the process or making it more efficient? And why is it that anybody would be resistant to the usage of plastic tubing?
Well, I think they were resistant because of the way that buckets and, you know, the traditional romantic vision of buckets hanging on trees and horse-drawn wagons, the traditional way. And I think that people thought that the use of plastic tubing was going to not only degrade the tradition, but degrade the process and the quality of maple syrup. And that's really not the case. It was more a method of transporting the syrup. It's very difficult to gather buckets make maple syrup that way. There's a labor cost. One person can gather about 500 buckets in a day, and it took seven people 2 days to gather 7,000 buckets. So the labor costs were formidable, and maple syrup is an expensive product. There are labor costs and there are a lot of energy costs because it has to be boiled down. So people were resistant to the sight of plastic tubing going up on the trees, and they wondered, where are the buckets, where are the horses? But it allowed the business to be profitable. It revolutionized the maple syrup industry and allowed people to do it as a business.
You tell us at one point, Bruce Bascom, he's one of the primary figures whom we follow in your story, you tell us that with the help of a cousin and someone else assembled, he assembled a tubing system that was the largest in New Hampshire. For a while at Bascom's, buckets and tubing coexisted, but gradually the buckets diminished and would only be seen around the sugar house for the benefit of visitors. So in other words, you have tourists who come through and who enjoy seeing the way things were once done. But in fact, that old way of doing things has been largely supplanted by this new technology, which in effect makes this industry profitable again.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a changeover in the generations. Bruce's father, Ken Bascom, was a risk taker and innovator himself. I mean, he sold his dairy herd in 1963 and went into maple syrup production full time. No one had ever done that before where he lived. But he used buckets, and even though he worked 80 hours a week, and worked very hard, he continued to make hay and cut firewood. When Bruce returned from college, they weren't very profitable, and so, you know, he started converting to plastic tubing. So the two generations sort of coexisted for a while, but eventually the buckets were phased out, and as Ken got older and retired, and I mean, I've seen actually two or three buckets hanging on the trees even lately, a few years ago, just to show them up there.
Mm. One of the things we see in your book through your eyes are various sugar houses, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and some were sort of technological marvels, and others were more charming and sort of evoked a different age. Explain to our listeners what essentially happens in the sugar house and what makes a sugar house so often a very intriguing and inviting place to visit.
No, that's wonderful. Bruce has said that from where we are in New Hampshire, now the maple syrup industry is far beyond New England. It's all over the place, but it's a very, very important part of the cultural fabric here. And Bruce has told me that from where he sits, on Mount Kingsbury in Acworth, New Hampshire, you could drive an hour in any direction and there would be 1,000 sugar houses. I haven't thought of any other kind of agriculture that has this architecture, the sugar house, where the sap is boiled. And there are, as you mentioned, there are all sorts of different ways of creating sugar houses, from an old mossy shack to a plumber's dream of steam pipes to boil sap and so on. It just depends on the personality and the skills of the syrup maker. But they are places where people go during this time of year when they're making syrup, and they socialize, they gather, they taste the syrup, they catch up with each other, they talk to each other. And that social part of the process and bringing the kids to have that wonderful experience of tasting maple syrup fresh off the evaporator, it's an important part of the social fabric here too. So the sugar houses kind of define the culture and they define the landscape. It's all connected to that very special flavor of maple in maple syrup. I mean, that flavor of maple is original to North America. It's an iconic flavor. It's the only original flavor that I can think of that comes from North America. And the culture itself and the sugar houses extend from it and are built upon it, this wonderful flavor of maple. And there's also an artificial industry, an $18 billion industry that comes as close as it can to duplicating that flavor of maple without ever using the word maple.
Right. As a matter of fact, I happen to be turned right to that page in your book, 154, where you talk about the huge market for imitation maple syrup. And the fact that there are all kinds of products on the shelves, Log Cabin, Vermont Made, Mrs. Butterworth, and they have no maple syrup in them whatsoever.
No, not.
So when we go into the grocery store, how apt are we to find real maple syrup on the shelves?
Well, you're likely to find it. You might have to look on a lower shelf for it. But there are fairly good distribution systems, and the Canadians have developed the markets as well in the distribution of maple syrup. And you can find it in a lot of the chain stores and in the larger supermarkets. The club stores have it. There's maple syrup there. You just have to look for it. It says pure maple syrup, and that's the key, pure maple syrup, not syrup made out of high fructose corn syrup.
Mm. One of the things that's intriguing about your book is how we learn about all kinds of terminology that sometimes evokes sort of other technologies or other products that have absolutely nothing to do with maple syrup or sap from trees. That, for instance, there are various grades that evidently make a real difference in how something is most likely to be used, and that when one talks about the whole industry, that sometimes we're throwing around terms like cartels to describe this explosive industry. Can you just say a quick word about each of those matters?
Well, as far as grades go, there's that's according to color. When the maple sap comes out of the tree, it's pure sucrose. And as the season progresses, as it gets warmer, as yeasts act upon the sap, those sugars are inverted and changed, and the sugars become a more complex group within the sap, and the mineral content of the sap changes. So as the season progresses, the maple syrup becomes darker. It starts off grade A light, and then it moves to amber, medium amber, and dark amber, and what they call grade B, which is a very dark syrup. People used to say that it was just good for cooking, but these days a lot of people prefer the darker grade B syrup, think it has more flavor. As a matter of fact, I talked to a sugar maker in Putney, Vermont, who had an account with a diner in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he was told by the waitresses that he should bring grade B, that when he served grade B syrup, the waitresses were getting better tips. So they complained.
Right.
As far as the cartel goes, that is referring to the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. Now, one of the big surprises to me when I was doing this research is that Quebec makes 70% to 80% of the world crop of maple syrup. And they have an agricultural union up there called the Federation. It consists of about 7,500 members. By joining together like that, they are able to set the world price and set a base price, which as a result has stabilized the industry and allowed sugar makers not only in Quebec to grow and expand, but also in the United States. The United States industry is expanding. Producers are able to get bank loans to put up tubing systems because of the stability of the price. Now, one other reason that it's called a cartel is because the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers also established what they call the Global Strategic Reserve, in which they set aside a huge amount of maple syrup and they store it in warehouses. I think they have three warehouses in Quebec. And sometimes this amount is double the total U.S. yearly crop. It's there in the event of a shortage. If the maple syrup production depends upon the weather, the cold nights, the warm days, the freezing and thawing, and that can be a very short season depending on the weather. So if there's a short crop, that surplus is there to be sold to packers and processors in Canada and the United States so that they can meet their orders and put maple syrup on the shelves. Mm. In the old days, it used to be up and down, and it was very hard to establish a stable market, and that's not the case anymore.
I'm glad you touched on the matter of temperature and weather, because, of course, that becomes a very predominant theme, especially as we reach the end of your book, when New England experiences an uncommonly warm spring, which has a very serious adversarial effect on the maple crop for the year. What is it about shifts in temperature that are so essential to a tree producing sap, which can be tapped and then utilized? Why is temperature such an important matter?
Well, that's because of the biology of the maple tree. They produce their sap, and they send their sap with sugar up to their branch tips to make leaves. That time of the year when it freezes at night and thaws during the day, when you think of it, that's a delicate time of the year when that band of heat is moving northward and spring is happening, and you get temperatures below freezing at night and above freezing during the day. That churning back and forth causes the sap to flow, and that's when maple syrup producers gather their sap. Now, if it's very cold, as it is this year, the season is delayed, and it can be a short season if it suddenly turns warm. Or in the case of what happened in 2012, when we had the warmest March in history, there were 14,000 temperature records that were broken. The season only lasted about 10 days and shut down right in the middle of March, when it should just be getting going strong, because the temperature got up into the 80s. And stayed there for, as I said, 10 days. Temperatures at night were in the 50s, and the trees were affected by this too. The sap was coming out of the trees not like that clear liquid, but like jelly. And in a couple of places in northern Vermont, where I talked to sugar makers, the sap was coming out of the trees like cottage cheese. So they shut down around March 19 or 20. For a while, until it got cold in the beginning of April and they started making syrup again. But in most places, that syrup after that point was what they call buddy. The leaves, the trees are starting to form buds, and the taste becomes a little sour.
Mm.
It's a very delicate process, and the trees are sensitive to it.
I remember seeing that word, sensitive, to describe maple trees, and saying something to the effect that that this sap to a tree is like blood in our body.
Yeah.
And just like we as human beings are affected by various matters, so too are maple trees, sometimes experiencing what you describe at one point as a disruption to their biological clocks.
Yeah.
You also describe, I think it's actually an expert you interviewed, describing how New England, in some respects, bears the brunt of certain environmental hazards in the United States. This expert calling New England the tailpipe of the nation. And this might be one reason why there has been some disruption of the maple industry in New England.
There
What's
is.
He talking about?
That's Professor Barry Rock from the University of New Hampshire, who has studied trees for all of his life. And he was talking about the fact that six major air currents in the United States pass over New England. This was big news to me. And as a result, he said it's a common term. New England is referred to among these scientists as the tailpipe of America. I moved to New Hampshire so that I could hike in the mountains. And he also said that at a certain zone of elevation between 3,000 and 4,000 feet, I think that is, these contaminants in the air and these air currents are very heavy. So that zone is called, they refer to it as the sewer, the tailpipe in the sewer in New England. So this is new news to me, but I have noticed at times when I've been hiking that my throat sometimes gets sore. And he mentioned and quoted a study from the Harvard Medical School of respiratory problems among hikers at these zones in the mountains of New Hampshire. So that is the case, and it also affects the maple trees. There have been a lot of studies out of the University of New Hampshire among Barrett Rock's group of the leaves of maple trees and also white pines and how they are affected by some of these chemicals and how at times the leaves are being broken down, which affects their ability to convert carbon dioxide into oxygen. Now, that is something that is of concern to maple syrup producers and anyone involved with forestry. But when you think about the tree's role in converting carbon into oxygen, carbon dioxide into oxygen, if that's affected, we have a very serious problem on our hands. I mean, it's a health issue anyway for us here in New England, but a greater issue if contaminants are affecting the leaves of trees.
Mm. In the closing minute or so, I wonder if you could just say a word about the array of wonderful characters you ended up meeting and the openness with which at least most of them sort of allowed you into their lives and into the work that they do. It must have been an extraordinarily exciting and satisfying experience for you as an author.
It really was. I mean, aside from that possible bad news that I was just mentioning, I got to meet Bruce Bascom, who is so knowledgeable and was so open to me talking to him and exploring the woods, but also sent me out to key people throughout the industry and all the people who are connected to his business. I mean, he buys syrup from 4,000 different producers and sells it all over the U.S. and in the world. So he connected me with his mentor, with his buyer in Canada, with his counterpart, David Marvin, who's also a fascinating individual who buys 50% of the syrup in Vermont and markets it as well. He put me in touch with these people and made it possible for me to talk to them. So you're right, I had a fantastic array of characters to be informed by and to have conversations with over the course of this story in the United States and in Canada, where they are just as passionate about making maple syrup as they are here.
And we get to meet these folks as we read your book, which is again called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest, published by DaCapo Press. Professor Douglas Wynut, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Monday on the morning show, I'm excited to share with you an interview with Jocelyn Alcott, who has written a book called International Women's Year, it actually looks back at an extraordinary gathering of women, of feminists from all around the world who gathered in Mexico City back in 1975. It was a tumultuous gathering in some respects, but an important one, which helped lay the groundwork for important dialogue and breakthroughs